Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free, year-round fundraising program for schools. You can learn more at schoolspiritvending.com.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
Well, you Better Leaders, back with Tom Hurek in today's episode. 40 episodes ago, we recorded our first show, number 56. And I'll tell you what, that was a top 10 episode, according to you, the listener. Now we're back. And Tom has written a new book, The 7 Keys to a Positive Learning Environment. So we dig into that book and some of the newer questions that we have on the show. But I want to say this. This book, every teacher needs on their shelf. So if you're a teacher, you need to pick it up. If you're a principal, AP, if you have the ability to purchase for your staff, superintendent, get it for your teachers. It reminded me a lot of Wong's first days at school. And I'm telling you, this is something that can revolutionize teachers' hearts, their mindsets in the classroom. And it's going to serve a lot of kids really, really well. I never take for granted that you tuned in. So thank you so much for listening. And I hope you enjoy the show. Well, hey, Better Leaders, I am here again and back 40 episodes ago. Episode 56, we had Tom Hurek on the show, and Tom is an amazing, amazing educator, has so much insight for you, and you could learn more about him on that last show, but we want to jump right into the episode today and provide a lot of value to you, the listener. Tom has a new book out, 7 Keys to a Positive Learning Environment in Your Classroom. And so, Tom, welcome to the show again.
Thank you. It is so good to be back. I had such a wonderful time last time, and I can't thank you enough for all the work you do just to get the word out. I know it's a labor of love for you, and I certainly have appreciated and benefited from our last interaction. I look forward to our chat this evening.
Yeah, it's been great, you know, and you made it up into the top 10, so I proudly display that link on the Better Leaders website. But this has been a relationship that I've enjoyed, you know, starting with you. And like I said, episode 56, learned so much. And now we're talking about positive learning environments, which is so important for the educator. I'm curious, what motivated you even from the beginning to start this book?
You know, it's an interesting one. For me, the book is more of an accumulation of things that have resonated with me. This is my 34th year. Had I stayed in my school district, I think this would have been the retirement year. And so I've been trying to pull aside all kinds of stuff that as I look over the years, what resonated with me, what made a difference. And let me just say up front, you know, I'd love to say that I always got it right. My goodness, I didn't. I engage in some what I know today were bad practices at the start of my career, not intentionally, even worse, you know, because I didn't think through. And so part of what I wanted to do was to create a book that I wanted every teacher to have on their desk that would be so dog-eared and tagged up because when they got caught in those moments, they'd have something to go reference. And that also was the reason why this is the first book I wrote solo. I've really enjoyed, I mean, my last book with Ken Williams,
we
spent so much time bouncing ideas off each other, and I knew that I really grew as an educator as a result of that. But this one was, you know, I felt like lots of things that had worked for me, and if it resonated with people, great. And if it didn't, then the only one they could, be upset with was me, right? So I wanted to do the piece that really spoke to the essence of that positive learning environment, starting right from the time a kid shows up at school, because I think it is the critical piece.
It absolutely is. I mean, it sets the tone, you know. Well, I know you believe this, but the work we do as educators, it's so easy to get frustrated and start talking about parents and outside forces and all this. But really, at the end of the day, all you can control are those few hours that you have the children within in the walls of your school. So how you set the tone, that positive learning environment is so important. Just to share a very quick anecdote, what I do is I'm at the car line. And as parents are dropping off their children, I'm turning that into a valet service, opening doors, high-fiving, you know, shaking hands, saying good morning, and singing songs if they're lucky, depending on the season.
Exactly. No, and it's perfect, right? And you know, I was just working with a newly appointed principal in Woodridge, Illinois, Principal Jake, He does the exact same things. He gets out there and he's new to the school and new to the role. And yet right away, he's got that real good positive dynamic from the moment the kids arrive, right? It's our one chance to really get their day started off. You know, I bet every one of your listeners, you know, anyone who's been in education for any length of time has had that moment where they've looked at a child and thought, if I could just take that kid home with me.
Yeah.
Right.
I've known educators that have done that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. How big's your house? Because you're going to take one a year. Right. And it starts to. But, you know, to your point, how about we just make the 6 hours they're with us the best 6 hours of their day? And how about when we as the adults get our precious couple of minutes in the day to interact with each other, that we use that time to elevate each other, to talk about how our environments are so positive. Rather than what I traditionally see or often see is that we gather to confess the sins of others, right? We talk bad about some of our students or their parents or our situation. All that does is drag us down, right? How about we elevate during that time?
Love the idea of elevating. Do you have some tactical things we can give the listeners in terms of how to make their culture an elevating culture?
Yeah, you know, some of the schools I've worked in, they start with a morning meeting. Right? It's a standing meeting. We don't get into the faculty lounge. We don't get into a classroom and sit down. We just gather right outside the main office. You know what? It has a number of impacts. Kids come in and they see the adults, their teachers, their support workers, their administrators gather talking about things that matter to them. Right? And it's because it's a standing meeting, it's short, and we share the good news. We used to start regular faculty meetings off with the first section, the first item on the agenda was kids first. Everybody come prepared with something that really worked well, because kids are why we're at work, right? So if we start talking in a positive, you know what happens. My goodness, you smile. Isn't it pretty quickly three other people around you are smiling?
That's the point, yeah.
You know, we share good news, and pretty quickly people want to. Now, it's hard. Sometimes we got to almost stop ourselves mid-moment and say, okay, what am I really looking for? What have I said we're all about? We're all about recognizing positive attributes. All right, I know in the class of 25 kids, you got one kid that's not prepared. How about we don't go to that kid first? How about we acknowledge all the kids that are prepared? Now, it's a shift, right? It's a thinking shift. As I said, it may require me to stop outside the door before I go in and remind myself, what am I looking for here? But we've got to be intentional about it.
Yeah, intentionality is key. Having that lens and setting the tone. I love that. I was taking notes like crazy. I bought an application. You can't hear me typing, but I was taking notes like crazy. And I really love that idea. It'll make a nice graphic. Kids first agendas. Love it. I mean, you got to keep the focus on what the main thing is. And that's our kids. Hey, we're going to veer off for a second, then go back. It's still a question about the book, but congrats, Tom, on writing your first solo book. What did you learn about yourself, or how is that process different than writing it with a buddy like Ken?
Man, it is so challenging in a different way because, as I said, you know, when you get stuck, you're the only person that can get you unstuck. Right now, I'm fortunate to have a wife who's always got a good way of looking at things and can process. She's not an educator, but she's able to do this. She spent a lot of time in schools as a volunteer, so she's able to help me synthesize some of that. So that was the first part, not having anybody else to really dive into. And then you know what? As you're going through the process, gosh, there were moments when I thought, really, is anyone going to want to read this? Right, this is sort of those moments of self-doubt where you think, come on, this is really not good stuff, until, the further along you get in it, you start to think, all right, now this has a bit of a flow to it. It resonates, connects with. Would I have any difficulty speaking about it? No. Okay, that's good. It's passed that test, etc. And then trying to draw on the wealth of knowledge. I mean, we live in such a fortunate time. I think we know more about teaching and learning today than certainly we have at any other point in my career. And so there's so many resources to tap into.
What would you say you're most proud of in relation to writing this book?
You know, as I said, to get the book in a cohesive fashion where it has a really good flow, you know, to have some real key folks that have been significant in my life read the book, you know, Anthony Muhammad, you know, provided some good feedback, and Chris Weber provided some good feedback. You know, my dear friend Charlie Coleman provided good feedback, Garth Larson, Lisa Blackstock, and all these people, as part of their conclusions, you know, Brian Butler came up with something along the lines of, this is a book every teacher should have on their desk. You can't help but feel inspired by that. That was my intention in writing it. But, you know, until you actually see that. So it's definitely a labor of love. You know, you want to make sure that it does. And so it's a book, you know, that I was quite proud to give to my youngest daughter who started her teaching career. She shared it with her principal. And, you know, to get some of that play is pretty neat.
That's really cool. And, you know, I read the book. I enjoyed it so much. Definitely encourage the listeners to get it. And listeners know all the links, especially to this text, be there for you in the show notes. It's different than Wong's, you know, first day of school, but I felt it had the similar heart. Like when I was reading this, Tom, because you sent it to me, you know, and I said, hey, you want to do a second show? Like people loved hearing you the first time. And I was so thrilled when you said yes. You sent me the book. I was pouring through it. And I'm like, every teacher needs this book. So it's interesting to hear that that's how your process kind of evolved and why you wrote it. Cause I had that same reaction. Like every teacher in my building needs this book.
And you know, it's funny you share that anecdote because one of the people that's been a supporter of mine at Solution Tree, Claudia Wheatley, you know, Claudia said, listen, we need you to write a book that is Harry Wong's first days of school.
What? No way.
Right. So it's amazing that you just brought that up because that was her challenge to me. Her charge to me is to write that kind of book that every teacher would want to have. So, you know, you had that sort of coming together of a variety of different people thinking that. And so, yeah, no, that's really insightful of you to share that.
I wish we had planned that too. That's sort of like a special podcast moment because, you know, listeners, we have pre-chats and we talk about, hey, is there anything you want to cover and that kind of stuff. That was definitely unscripted, but it went through my mind. And, you know, reading the book, I just got so much value. So I wanted to tell you today and I was hoping you'd resonate with it.
Oh, that's perfect.
Hey, you kind of bring up this idea of teacher presence within your text. And so I'm just wondering if you can unpack that for our listeners.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, and whether you're a teacher or whether you're in a formalized leadership position, let's be clear, you know, time's our most precious resource, and how we dole out that time during the day really is the indicator of what we value the most. You know, and for teachers, let's be clear, every kid more than anything else wants teacher time, right? How we now, you know, dispense that time, given how packed our days are, really is an indicator to kids. If you have a kid who is really challenging, they don't need to only be acknowledged when they are misbehaving, for example, because that then just becomes the way to get teacher attention. So you'll see an increase in the misbehavior. You know, the balance of we need to make sure we are heavily involved in the lives of our most able students. Right. As much as they are really good, independent learners in an academic area, they still need other pieces. They still need that relationship building. They still need the human contact. They still need the acknowledgement, like all of us need as human beings. You know, if you're a principal or assistant principal listening to this podcast, you need to also be aware that your presence indicates to your classroom, i.e. the teaching staff, what you value the most, right? And so that notion of presence starts to really drive what we see as important, right? There's nothing that is a substitute for you to be there with the children, to be there with the adults, than your time, your presence in the moment.
That's good. What would you say is that in terms of the principal presence, what do you think is the most important aspect of it?
You know, I think, again, principals are charged with a significant responsibility, as you well know, and there's lots of stuff that comes down the pipes. And you know, what I used to say to the principals that I had supervised is this: the hours of school are people time. The hours after school are paper time. In other words, I don't want you to be in your office unless it is absolutely critical in the moment. Right? I ought not to be able to phone school and find you in your office regularly. You've got to be out and about. You know, you've got to be in classrooms. You've got to be that presence in the building that kids know, that teachers know. And it ought to not be, you know, so formal that the minute you walk into a classroom, everything stops.
Mm.
I want you to just flow through and flow through as many of the classrooms. I want you to have your teachers understand that when there's a significant change, if you're going to bring in something, I'm a big fan of response intervention and instruction or multi-tiered systems of support. If you're going to bring that in as an initiative, as a leader in a school, you need to make sure you're part of all the meetings going on. Can you be as fluent in all of the minutiae? No, but you've got to structure your day so that you have time for the things that you've said are important.
Yeah, that's been a struggle of mine as a first year principal, just getting to all those meetings and balancing what's more important.
Yeah.
I missed some meetings early in the year, and I missed some celebrations like baby showers and those kind of things because I prioritized welcoming the kids to campus and their safety, making sure they're arriving safe to school, and that. You know, it got me, you know, it kind of ended up biting me in the butt a little bit because I unintentionally hurt some feelings.
Yep.
And that's been the hardest part because, you know, it's not necessarily that I want to be liked or loved by everybody, but I want people to have a sense that, you know, I have their best interests, you know, in my heart. And it's like rats, you know, I didn't mean to do that. And so you just, you know, adjust your time. Do you have anything else in terms of, I guess, tactics or tips for our listeners if they have that similar struggle? How do you figure out those priorities or you know, where to be? What meeting can I make? Which one can I miss?
And I think, you know, and it's also balanced off by what you've just said, right? And I think, let's be clear, it's not the end of the world that you missed the events. The fact that you've responded the way you did and that it mattered, I think, is important, right? But as you've come to realize, you don't get a chance to go back either, right? So as we start to look at what we've asked teachers to do, what we've asked our school community to do, the things that we say are priority, you know, whether it's around a grading system, around common formative assessment, around RTI, around establishing a professional learning community, all the things that we know have positive impact, then – you know, as I said, you've got to find time to be a piece of that. I think when we look at faculty meetings, let's get away from any time being devoted to trivia, you know, the immovable things. I don't want to see much faculty meeting time spent on whether or not the assemblies should come in on Wednesday or Thursday. You know, that's irrelevant because if that gets away from us having a good discussion about teaching and learning, we got a problem, right? So how do you as the leader talk about? And I think, you know, what you've just touched on, how do you also make sure we build in celebration, right? Because celebration is critical, especially after we ask people to engage in hard work. Celebration becomes a thing that, left unchecked, starts to drive wedges, right?
Well, speaking of celebrations, it's kind of like having this expectation of what you want the school to be like, you know, the kind of atmosphere and environment you want to create. That's so important at the classroom micro level as well. And I know that you're a big proponent, you talk about in the book, in terms of establishing classroom expectations with kids. What would you like to say about that? I mean, I always did that, okay? I guess the better question is this. I always did that, and I don't know if that was just sort of my nature or what. I learned it, I don't know. But it was something that over a decade, you know, of being in the classroom as a teacher, it just made sense. Now I'm at a school, and this is not a knock at all. The kids behave pretty much perfectly. It's really like the most well-behaved school I've ever been in. But their voice isn't included in that classroom expectation piece, and that was curious to me. So maybe for our listeners that don't quite get that yet or haven't been exposed, what could you say about establishing classroom expectations with kids?
Yeah, and I try to talk about early on in the book the difference. You know, we need to delineate the difference between expectations and rules, because I find a lot of people are really ready to and eager to get rules in place, right? And rules, you know, as I talk about in the book, tend to be reactionary. You know, it's the proverbial horses left the barn situation. Now we got to come up with a reason why there's no horses left in the barn. So we make a rule that says no horse shall ever leave the barn again. It doesn't make sense. You know, the old adage, rules are made to be broken, is so true in schools today. Whereas expectations start to be lifelong. They aren't just about what you do in grade 3, grade 6, grade 9, but they are what you do in life. There isn't an adult construct that does not thrive on respect, right? There isn't a job situation. There isn't a social interaction where respect isn't important. So when I start to work with you on respect, and that's, you know, obviously what you've done in your time, that's why it resonates, it builds. If instead I have a rule, then the kids are really quick to interpret the rule in a different way, right? So, you know, I had an example of that where, you know, the teacher and the classroom had made up their 10 classroom rules, and they beautifully illustrated these, and then there was a substitute teacher in and very quickly scribbled out in purple marker was rule number 11, no making weapons out of cardboard. Mm. And you just know what happened in the class that day.
Bunch of knives out of cardboard.
Yeah, right? Now, listen, if you're the kid who wants to break the rule and you see a rule that says no making weapons out of cardboard, what's the first thing that starts running through your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can make it out of wood. I can make it out of plastic. I can make it out of metal. Okay, teacher said weapons, right? What do they mean by weapons? And they'll get into all these different definitions, right? If you've ever been in an area where there's snow, what happens the first time there's snow?
Mm-hmm.
No throwing snow.
But so what do the kids do?
Yeah, right? Well, what if I scoop snow? What if I kick snow? What if I toss snow, right? Yeah. You know, whereas if we have respect, it's pretty clear.
Right.
What does respect look like? Respect looks like you don't get in anybody else's personal space. You don't do anything that, right? We talk about all the different examples. Respect is lifelong. Responsibility is lifelong. Safety is lifelong. Those are really good expectations for us to deliver on in school and practice.
Thing about rules too is they're not warm. They're pretty well. They try to be black and white.
Yep.
They're not inviting at all. Expectations, you know, those are welcoming. Those are warm.
Yep.
To me, they invite kids into a larger conversation because, like you said, respect, that's a lifelong skill, right?
For sure.
And not making weapons out of cardboard. Like, what are you? You know, yeah. Of course, we shouldn't do that. But what's at the core of it? You know, the book didn't necessarily talk about this, but, you know, as a principal in how you treat your staff, are you talking in the terms of expectations or are you talking in terms of rules, you know?
And how would we respond to that, right? Do we respond well when our leadership just tells us about all the rules of our conduct?
No.
I think we would bristle under that as well. And, you know, it makes for the exact opposite of a positive learning environment.
Yeah, or a positive working one. To tell you the truth, I mean, even at 38 years old, for me, when somebody says you must do it this way, I ask myself, is this something worth, you know, fighting for? And I don't respond very well to those type of directives, you know, and sometimes to my own negative consequences that I know are going to come, but I can't take it. I don't know why. I don't know if it's like some type of reptilians sort of, you know, innate thing in me. But I want autonomy. You know what I mean? I want creativity. And when I feel suffocated, I don't respond well at all.
No, it's what Ken and I talked about in the book, you know, Starting a Movement, the previous book, the difference between collective commitment and compliance, right? If you're going for compliance, yeah, you can have a whole series of rules and that's what you'll spend your whole life doing is getting people to behave according to the rules.
And you're not gonna, I don't know, what kind of beautiful school will be created out of that? But we're starting to get off a little bit, so I'll rate it in. I take full responsibility for that one. Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free year-round fundraising program for schools, and the best part is that it's absolutely free. With School Spirit Vending, we do all the work, you just cash a check. You can increase school spirit with custom stickers for your school and raise funds at the same time. No upfront costs, no volunteers, no selling. Sick of the same old ways of raising money for your school? Check out schoolspiritvending.com. Hey, so working with students who challenge us, and you kind of talk about the problem of a label, but I love this idea. I took it out of the book, Inspiring Hope for the New School Year. How do we do that, especially with kids that are tough?
Yeah. So I think, again, you know, how we start the year off. Let's be clear. Everybody comes back to a new school year on a bit of a high, right? The energy level is incredible. Well, that's the best time to try and start to shape the expectations, to review those expectations, to go out of your way to build positive connections for kids. People talk about, well, where am I going to find the time for that? Well, listen, you have a choice as to how you spend your time. You can spend it up front and build things the right way, or you can spend more of it throughout the year in remediation and trying to correct, in being reactive, right? As we just talked about, none of that is positive energy. And none of it is value added. You know, I talk a whole lot about the notion of chase time. Well, chase time is born by us overreacting, reacting after the fact, you know, dragging people down and the energy level down because we didn't spend time up front trying to build. When kids come to school at the beginning of the year, even for the kid, let's say you got little Danny and you know little Danny is going to be your biggest challenge in grade four because he was in grade three, he was in grade two, etc. How you approach that child? How do you ensure that the 10 months with you will be unlike any other, right? So let's say you find something the kid likes. Can you start to build that? Can you have that kid be your helper? It's not going to rocket the kid to the top of the charts academically, but it will guarantee a different and better approach for that kid and for that kid's year. Now, if as a team of educators, we commit to that year after year after year, isn't that our best hope for turning something around with our most challenging kid? I'd like to believe that anyone listening to this would agree with that notion. Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? Because we know what current practice is getting us.
Yeah, it needs a change.
Yep.
That's good, Tom. You talked about the I wish my teacher knew activity, which is just incredible, incredible.
Yeah.
Great way to get feedback from kids to their teachers.
Yeah.
What kind of things did you see classroom teachers learn about their kids as a result of that activity?
Yeah, you know, there's a comparable one called Tell Them From Me, and it's a survey that we gather information. Now, listen, the key thing for any of those is to make sure that we have some attempt to respond to the information, right? There's nothing worse than gathering information from kids and having it never utilized. Right? What was the purpose? And if you want to do the surveys every year, you know, I suggest to schools, you know, do it twice. Do it once at the beginning of the year and once towards, you know, the two-thirds mark of the year. And then look at that information, right? So, you know, some of the things kids talk about, what they liked about their school. You know, when a kid can say something like this, and I'm just reading a section from the book, I also like it because I'm accepted for who I am and usually don't have any trouble making friends, right? That indicates to me that we got a pretty healthy culture there, right? The kid didn't have to go into any great detail about, but that they're already feeling welcome, right? They're feeling like this is possible, that they're accepted for who they are. When kids, you know, one of the questions was that there's at least one staff member that you can go to with concerns or problems. When a student responds, I do not go to someone for help because I'm too embarrassed, and in the past I've gone to a teacher and every time they told me to ignore it, so I stopped asking teachers for help. Again, I think that's quality information. That's not meant to beat up on any individual adult, but if that starts to come through as a theme for kids, then I think as the adults, we've got to stop and say, so what are we doing now that's making it hard for kids to approach us? Not looking to name, shame, or blame anybody, but what can we collectively do so that our kids feel like this is a comfortable environment where they can? So I think we've got lots of ways of gathering information. Now, what do we do with the information once gathered?
What do you do, too, for the attitudes that don't necessarily want to go there with you, don't want to talk about that? Not they take it personally. It's not meant to be personal, but we're here for kids and we want to do what's best for them. And so we're going to talk about real stuff. And sometimes it might not look pretty.
No. And again, as the leaders in schools, the leadership's got to make sure they create that environment also, that as a group of educators, the teaching staff and the support staff, that we can get together and talk about our kids, not yours and mine, not at a point where we're looking to name, shame, and blame the adults for a lack of student performance, because then we'll see what we've always seen and people will quickly retreat. The critical moment is this: during times of stress, when we get challenged the most in schools, do we turn to each other or do we turn against each other? If we turn against each other, we're not going to change anything that's currently going on. We will be in a situation where whatever's happening in school now will continue to happen. We'll be on a scale of 1 to 10, a school that's a 5 or a 6, maybe a 7 in a good week. It's Collins' old work, right? Good's the enemy of great. If you're happy just being good, then you're probably not going to push to be great. I think our kids deserve great.
Absolutely. Speaking of great, when you think of the word leader, who's the first person that comes to your mind?
I go all the way back to and I shared the story with you last time we talked. John Dressler, the first principal I ever encountered, right? On a very practical level. You know, when I think big picture, I mean, I love, you know, going back and reading some of the early stuff when people wrote about Mahatma Gandhi, some of the early Churchill stuff. I love reading some of, Kennedy's early thinking. So there's lots of ones that come to mind in Canada. We've had some significant leaders over time that, you know, start to inspire. But as I said, on a very practical level, I go back to the first principal I had, you know, who really gave me some things to sort of sink my teeth into.
What's your first hour of the day look like, Tom? I'm curious if you have any morning rituals or routines.
Usually that's the time I tend to get up and go running. I'm still trying to make sure I get that regular routine in. I'm pretty much an early riser. I don't tend to, even if I manage to stay in a bed by 6 o'clock, I'm usually awake. So I tend to get up early and do some stuff. If I'm in some places, as I was last week where it was minus 40, wasn't getting up for an early morning run. So, you know, I do a little bit of other processing. Sometimes I'll jot down notes for a book or something else. Try to do a little bit of reflection at that point, a little bit of, whatever I can do to get going. Yeah.
Going back to like book processing and being, you know, author, how long does it take you to write a book? And then how long until you're ready to start the next one?
You know, it's usually about a 6 month sort of process from start to finish. Now, to be fair, you know, as I said, I'm constantly jotting down ideas and sort of, you know, listening to people's phrasing. And listen, I think I've gone through most of the podcasts that you have. You know, you get inspired by hearing. I like looking at TED Talks, some of those things. So I've got some things already formulated. But yeah, you know, usually from start to finish. And then whenever I finish a book, I tell my wife I'm not going to write another book. You know, I'm going to just take a break. And that usually lasts for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then, you know, start thinking about and jot some more ideas down. And so there seems to be a process going now. So my most recent excuse for her as to why I'm now working on another book was we just had another grandchild. So our youngest grandchild, Bodie Thomas, was born about 6 weeks ago.
Congrats.
And I said, Bodie hasn't had his name in a book dedication yet, so I have to write another book
so
I can dedicate it to Bodie. So now that'll get me through one more book, and I don't know what I'll do after that, but yeah.
Very good. Hey, is there a book idea you're glad you never wrote?
You know, there are some times, you know, when you think about, and particularly around the behavior things, right? Like I said, I think I had some bad ideas about, you know, behavior and sort of getting kids to behave the appropriate way. I think I was probably much harder when I first came out of my teacher training and believing, the old myth that the quiet classroom was the most effective learning space.
Mm.
You know, that notion we used to have as you walked around the halls looking for that dead quiet room, because clearly that's where the learning was happening. So now, I much rather hear what I called in a recent blog post that beautiful noise where there's really high engaged kids and you can just tell, right, that's the place, you know, you'd want to have your kid go to class.
That quiet classroom myth in terms of the best classroom, do you think that's the worst leadership advice you've ever been given, or was it something else?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And I think it definitely was from that era of compliance, right? We are going to make you all fit this way So it was definitely a compliance model and very much an old school model, you know, and I think we've learned, as I said earlier, a whole lot more about teaching and learning in 35 years, as every other profession has learned.
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, medicine doesn't look the way it used to, you know, any skilled mm-hmm. trades doesn't look the way they used to. So why would we expect that teaching would be the same?
Exactly. Yeah. Cars are starting to drive themselves. And so our schools, they better change.
Yeah.
Tom, concerning school leadership, what have you changed your mind about in the past few years?
You know, I think I've really recognized the value of a couple of things, being clear on your purpose and crafting that purpose as a larger group rather than, you know, the people within, you know, some of the leaders, some of the leaders that emerge, that we've really got to try to get to every voice. You know, just as we would expect in a classroom, we've got a range of learning styles. We should expect the same thing in a faculty, that we would have a range of learning styles and capacities, right? You know, somebody on your school staff is the very best adult in terms of mathematics, and somebody struggles the most. You are going to have visual learners in your faculty and auditory learners and tactile learners. You're going to have people who need much more process time than a typical faculty meeting provides. So I've come to realize that in order to get to all those people, there should be very few times where we are needing an immediate decision made. Now, as you know, in this role, sometimes the boss over top of you says, "Hey, Danny, I need the answer by 3 o'clock today."
Mm-hmm.
All right. If I look back over time, I can say this quite clearly. Anything we did was better more often than not than anything I did. Right? The we meant it was much more fully formed. The I's more often than not came from an arbitrary deadline imposed by somebody else. I didn't get a chance to talk to the brilliant people I worked with. I tried to consider their thinking, but I didn't get a chance to validate it.
In addition to the 7 keys to a positive learning environment in your classroom, is there another book you'd like our listeners to check out or you'd recommend?
Yeah, you know, obviously the book that was the precursor to this, Pyramid of Behavior Interventions, was the one that looked at a whole school approach, right? And I got to write that with my dear friend Charlie Coleman and Chris Weber. And so we wrote that book, and that's probably about 7 years ago. And Charlie and I, in particular, are still doing lots of work built on that. And that was a whole school approach. And, you know, part of what drove this book was the notion of, okay, now how do you make that down to the classroom level while still building on the same 7 keys? You know, so obviously that's, you know, something that that resonates with me. You know, I think a lot of it depends on where you're at in your school's growth. You know, I mentioned earlier, I've done a number of books on response, intervention, and instruction, the single most research practical approach to guiding what we do in schools as part of our professional learning communities, right? So I think that there's clearly that, you know, obviously, when you're looking for the inspiration to get started, you know, all of the work by Rick Dufour and company, I mean, you know, everyone is been saddened by his passing, but I believe, you know, his legacy will be in the fabulous books that he's put together and the practical approach he delineated for educators to build the kinds of communities that, you know, you and I have been talking about now in a couple of podcasts, right? So I think that's really foundational stuff, you know, and obviously, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, you know, the book that Ken and I put together that we think has really altered a lot of the approach and got people to think more about establishing a collective commitment versus the traditional compliance model.
In addition to running, what else are you obsessed with right now?
You know, I think between the running, the writing, and trying to spend time with family, that those occupy most of my time. I would be probably, you know, kicked out of being in the Canadian Brotherhood if I didn't mention that I'm a fanatic hockey fan.
There you go.
So, you know, that, trying to fit that in, and I do try to take in as many games as I possibly can. Sports in general, you know, appeal to me. It's just a different look at, you know, how people process things. I think it's always interesting that way. And then I like to read. You know, I try to read lots. You know, when I'm on the road, I'm always grabbing newspapers and I'm always grabbing stuff. And now I obviously all of us have more access to things as a result of social media and technology. So, you know, you can't help but keep on top of stuff.
Who's your hockey team?
I grew up in Montreal, so it's the Montreal Canadiens. But I live just outside of Vancouver now, so I do have tickets to see the local team. Now, last night was...
You can't even say the name, the local team.
The Vancouver Canucks.
Oh, there we go.
you just wanted me to say that because when you were in Chicago, you guys like to beat up on us. So
we've had some good years.
Yeah, last night was an interesting one because Vancouver played Montreal, and so it was...
It was going to cheer
on the home team, but not cheering for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you could be automatically good at something, what would it be?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You know, I used to, I love doing things with my hands, but I'm not really skilled with machinery, right? So I've got some stuff in my house that I've built, and I use that term loosely because I've had to have people guiding me through every step of the process. You know, every once in a while they have to pull me aside and say, okay, Tom, count up your fingers. You still have 10? Good, we can go to the next step. Right. You know, so I think I'd love to be better at that. You know, I enjoyed, you know, the communication pieces as much as I've now written 15 books. I'm still a work in progress there. I'd like to be a better writer. You know, it's still a process for me. And certainly when I was in school, that wasn't a strength I had at all. So, you know, it's a good thing. You know, the last thing I really want to do is play an instrument. And I'm committed to learning how to play an instrument at some point. I've just got to wait until that moment is right for me to do that.
If you could put a message on all school marquees, Tom, across your nation, what would it say for just a day?
You know, it's a real simple one. It's about kids first. Kids first. We all are fortunate to have these great jobs in education because kids show up. Schools exist as learning centers for children, not employment centers for adults. And as long as we keep the notion of kids first, and it's changed. My goodness, when I went to school, if you had a graduation rate that looked around 70% or so, you know, you were doing a fine job. I think those days are gone. I think we got to get to 100% of our kids. I don't know how any of them that we leave behind will find their way in the adult world. We'll be able to carve a path, right? So kids first, we got to have that attitude going in. You know, I start the book off with this whole notion of having a must-have attitude, right? We've just got to believe, you know, that it's critically important to create that positive classroom environment. It's going to be messy. It's going to be uneven. It's going to be complex, but it's absolutely necessary. And every teacher has to be full on for that engagement.
I must have attitude. I love that. Tom, time flies when you're having fun. This is episode number 2. And I want to thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any actionable steps you'd like the listeners to take as a result of listening to today's show? And what's the best way to get a hold of you?
One of the things that I really think is a good actionable step, and it's one that I can say certainly happened to me over my career. And I talk about the notion of moving from direct to correct to connect. When I started teaching, the approach we all took was the direct approach, where we just told the kid what they had to stop doing and the consequence. We went to the correct approach, where we then tried to provide some correction, but we were still fairly consequence focused. I believe we got to get to the connect approach, which is to build in the teaching as well as the consequence. So, you know, if, for example, the kid was calling out, in the direct approach, we would have just said, Danny, stop calling out now, go to the office. In the correct approach, we would have said, Danny, stop calling out. You know you're supposed to raise your hand. In the connect approach, it's Danny. Remember, we're built on a foundation of respect. And one of the ways we show respect is when one person is talking, the rest of us are listening, right? If we really want it to take hold. So I think that's a tangible step, process, thinking that all of our listeners can go through in order to shift some of that. And it's amazing to me, once you get to connect, how it shifts the attitude, the approach, the essence in a classroom. You know, as always, I'd love to hear from folks. You know, Twitter is easy, just at T Hirk, thirk@gmail.com. Facebook is just Tom Hirk. Any of those methods, I'd love to hear from any of your listeners. And certainly I'm committed to sharing the content of this book and any of the others, you know, that I've been fortunate to be a part of, as we start to build better outcomes for every student, right? And I don't use the word every and all lightly. I think we've got to be getting to them all, because lives truly are hanging in the balance.
Well, better leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to the podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Tom. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Tom in the search bar. In the show notes page will pop up. You'll get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Tom, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you, Danny.
Better Leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Have you gotten value from today's show? Help me reach even more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. Click the podcast artwork and press the Show Some Love link to leave an honest rating and review. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, patrons would sponsor artists to create something the patron valued. Would you consider becoming a patron of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast? If you found this podcast valuable, if the show has pushed your thinking about leadership, and if you've benefited in any way, then I would be honored if you would become a sponsor. Sponsorship is easy. Head over to patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. If you pledge 10 bucks a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every other month. That's patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes. Do you have a question or need some leadership advice? I want to connect with you. I read every email, tweet, snap that's sent to me. Links are in the show notes to connect via email and social media. Better Leaders, Better Schools is a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network. Podcast for educators, podcast by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.